WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. A poll taken in Russia not long ago posed this question. Who are the three most important people who have defined Russia in the 20th century? The answer came back Lenin, Stalin, and the third person was Andrei Sakharov, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the developer of the Soviet hydrogen bomb, who, along with his second wife, Elena Bonner, became a tireless fighter for human rights. Before the downfall of the Soviet Union, Sakharov was exiled to Gorky, went on three debilitating hunger strikes, and was forced to rewrite his memoirs from scratch several times after his manuscripts were stolen by the KGB. My guest today is Richard Lorre, who has written a new biography of Andrei Sakharov. Lorre wrestles with the complex question of Sakharov's transformation from a scientist accepted into the highest Soviet circles to a dissident whose view of the world had completely changed. Sakharov started, of course, as a scientist, and when one thinks of a scientist, particularly one enthralled by theory, by quantum physics, string theory, the nature of thermonuclear reactions, one doesn't normally think of an activist fighting for human rights. And Sakharov did some of his best work before he really took an interest in politics. In fact, wouldn't it be fair to say that often freedom to create in science isn't necessarily blocked by authoritarian systems, and in fact, it's sometimes the one place where people in those systems can be creative?
That is an interesting paradox. Sometimes it's true that, well, at least it was true in the Soviet Union, that the physicists, especially after Stalin realized what the potential of atomic weapons was, that is to say, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the physicists in the Soviet Union were given rather wide latitude, and which meant, on the most practical level, they were paid a lot of money. They had access to materials, magazines, journals from the West that no other Russian could get near, and if had in his possession, would be in trouble. So they were of some use to the state, but as Stalin remarked candidly in private conversation, well, we can always shoot them later, meaning that their utility was not ever going to encroach on his authority. So they did have a certain amount of freedom, and they did amazingly creative work. I mean, it's an odd, not only the scientists, but it's some of the Russian writers did excellent work under terrible conditions. And the odd thing is that after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, I, for one, expected to see a great outpouring of painting and novels and literature in general, and nothing of the sort happened, as if the dynamic of repression and counter force somehow was necessary for the Russian creative dynamic, because, as we know from in the last 10 years anyway, not a great deal has come out of there.
I wonder, when I was reading Sakharov, a biography, I was wondering about what he thought of his role as developer of the hydrogen bomb. I started thinking of that famous quote, was it Oppenheimer, you know, I am Shiva, destroyer of worlds. And how did he feel about his own role? Did he feel guilty? Did he feel proud? Was it a mixture of things? Do you have any sense of how he confronted that role?
I don't think Sakharov had a scintilla of guilt about developing the Soviet H-bomb. The Soviet Union had just been through a terrible war on its own territory. The Nazis had invaded and come to kill people. I mean, what could be worse than Nazis coming to kill you? He had seen all that. He understood perfectly well at the time that parity was the only security for his country. So he never had any great second thoughts about his work on the H-bomb. He wasn't the kind of person who would even waste emotional time feeling needless guilt. It simply wasn't in his character. When he was working on the H-bomb, he was doing it for two reasons. One, because it was so scientifically exhilarating to unleash the energy that drives the sun and the stars, which is how he put it, and because he felt it was his patriotic duty. He called himself a soldier in the new scientific war. That's pretty much an exact quote. The United States of America had used the atomic bomb twice, and by 1949, it was clear that the wartime alliance between the Soviet Union and the United States was completely over. So simply on the level of survival, the patriotism of survival, it was important to make sure that your country had parity with any other country. And at that time, Sakharov believed that his society, the Soviet society, was what he called a breakthrough society. He believed in socialism. He was, to the degree that he was aware of what went on in the West, he was appalled by its inequities of wealth, its social injustice, and its tacky mass culture.
Now, when Sakharov first began to buck up against the system, it had happened when he started arguing against nuclear testing. How did that lead him to rethink his whole worldview?
Actually, it was very interesting how this all happened. It all began with a pencil and paper. He sat down one day and figured out that every megaton tested releases a certain percentage of fallout into the atmosphere, and that it can be realistically calculated that every megaton would, over the course of time, invisibly, cause 10,000 deaths. And we all have friends who are dying from cancer at young ages now, and every time that happens to someone in my life, I have to wonder if this isn't an instance of Sakharov's prophecy coming true. Now, he made that simple calculation. One megaton equals approximately 10,000 deaths. That did not directly lead him to say testing should be ended. It led him to think that any testing that was not absolutely necessary should be ended. Now, the point was, in the Soviet Union, some tests were purely scientific. Let's blow this thing up and see what we get. But some of the tests had a definite political aspect to it. For example, when Khrushchev had decided to renew the attack on Stalinism at a major party conference, the 22nd, he wanted what Sakharov called a big bomb to be exploded on that very day to lend the sort of thunderous authority to his voice. It was a purely political test. And it was that kind of test and other similar tests that Sakharov initially opposed. And so you could say that his road to dissidence and his road to human rights began with two things. One was the pencil and paper he used to figure out that each megaton tested will cause 10,000 deaths, and his willingness to stand up to Khrushchev and say unnecessary tests should not be conducted.
But this transformation, it seems to me, when I look at it, it seems quite incredible. Here is a man who is doing science in an installation that apparently was designed or was certainly built by slave labor, correct? And he even says that he saw prisoners walking around and really never thought about them. So how did that consciousness change? How did someone change to someone who thought primarily about philosophy and science to someone who suddenly was in the forefront of the battle for human rights?
Sakharov always believed in evolution rather than revolution. He saw in nature and in society that the best path for change was slow, incremental alterations. And I would say that more or less describes the inward transformation that he went through. It was a gradual, daily awakening to the reality of life around him, which came through thinking, which came through reading, which came through contact with other people. And he began to actively look into the crimes of the Stalinist past, the successes of the American economy, the problems of the world in other places, population, ecological problems. He began to give real thought and real time to all the big questions of the era. And by 1968, he had written his book Peace, Progress, and Intellectual Freedom, which was published in its entirety by the New York Times. It was about a 70 or 80-page essay, which is one of the few books that the Times have ever published in its entirety because it was of such great importance. So anyway, sometime between the death of Stalin in 1953, which Sakharov genuinely mourned, and the summer of 1968, he had created for himself a complete worldview, which was never fixed and never inflexible, but now he had his own standpoint to view his country and the world, and on that basis to take action, some of which were very personally costly to him. For example, allowing the publication of that essay in the New York Times and abroad outside of the Soviet Union immediately cost him his job at the installation, and he was never to set foot there again except to go and clean out his desk.
My guest is Richard Lorre. His new book is Sakharov, a biography. We'll talk more with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is author Richard Lorre. His new book is Sakharov, a biography. Richard Lorre is also a producer of television and film documentaries and other books, including Russia Speaks and Hunting the Devil. In 1956, Nikita Khrushchev gave his historic and, at that time, astounding speech to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, revealing the brutality of Stalin's purges. This event had incredible reverberations in Russia and all over the world, certainly among communists all over the world, including in the United States. Isn't it hard for people today under 50 to comprehend the impact of that speech?
I mean, I don't know if this is a useful analogy, but in a certain sense, some of the turmoil that the Catholic Church is going through these days, if the Pope himself turned out to be a child molester, that would send a shockwave through the Catholic community of the world that would be similar, I would imagine, to the shockwave that passed through the socialist community of the world when the full extent of Stalin's crimes was revealed by Khrushchev. Not that the full extent, but...
certainly a lot.
But certainly a great deal of what Stalin had actually been about was revealed by Khrushchev in 1956.
One of the most amazing stories that you tell in Sakharov, a biography, is about the tenacity that Sakharov had in writing his biography over and over, his autobiography, I guess, his memoir, as the KGB stole those writings when he was in Gorky, and he would begin again and again and again. Tell that story.
The KGB stole Sakharov's autobiography in manuscript from him twice, the first time by tricking him in a dentist's office and leaving his bag, which he always kept with him because he was aware they were wanting to steal it. And then again by smashing the glass of his car, spraying his face with a narcotic, aerosol narcotic, and grabbing the same bag which he had the manuscript in it for the second time. Now that was a manuscript of something like 800-900 typed and handwritten pages. He was suicidally depressed each time after the manuscript was stolen from him, but once he got through that suicidal depression, he simply sat down and started from scratch and wrote the 1,000 pages all over again. He simply was not about to be defeated by the KGB.
Let's talk for a moment about his second wife, Elena Bonner. She's a Jewish woman. She's still alive. She was attacked by many in the Soviet Union as kind of the evil genius behind this man who swayed this pure scientist into politics. What do you see as the truth of their relationship, and how influential was she on him?
Well, actually, what Elena Bonner says about Andrei Sakharov is actually what I just said from a different point of view, that once Andrei Sakharov had made up his mind, no force in the world could dissuade him. And even though Elena Bonner is a considerable force as a person, she had no power to dissuade him once he had set his course. Bonner likes to tell the story of there was an explosion in a Moscow subway, which the KGB blamed on Armenian terrorists. I think that was in the early 70s. And Sakharov had a very strong sense that the whole thing was a KGB charade. I mean, it actually happened, but it was the KGB who did it for their own purposes. And Bonner absolutely told him not to say that publicly. The KGB would never forget or forgive such a statement. And of course, Sakharov, after thinking it through, went ahead and did exactly that. And Bonner was right. The KGB never forgot or forgave that incident. And when they got the chance, punished him severely. But it is a good example of the fact that if Sakharov made up his mind to do something, neither the KGB nor Elena Bonner nor anything else on earth could sway him.
What was exile in Gorky like? What did that life seem like, look like, feel like?
I think the essence of the exile in Gorky was isolation. I think the attempt was to give Sakharov the outward trappings of a reasonable life. Gorky is a nice city. It's not deep in Siberia. It's a city with a kind of European old town heart. It has movie theaters. It has art galleries. It has a little something. But no one could approach Sakharov on the street. No one could communicate with Sakharov without official permission. And neither could Sakharov communicate with anyone without official permission. So I think it was, and of course the apartment was completely bugged, so you had always had that sense of you could be sitting in your living room with your wife, but knowing that every sigh and whisper was being listened to, probably live, not even recorded, but live. So it was a very 1984-ish experience, outwardly not bad. You had a reasonable apartment in a nice city, and yet you're in a kind of super space-age plastic bubble of isolation where nothing can reach you and you can't reach anyone. On the other hand, Sakharov was a realist, and Bono was too, and they made the best of it. He did some good scientific work there. He wrote his memoirs there. They had a lot of time to be together, which they enjoyed greatly, because back in Moscow previously, there had been so many activities going on constantly, so many causes, trials, arrests, that they never had time for each other. So, ironically, I call that chapter The Blessings of Exile in the book, because there were some blessings to it.
Now, he, after Gorbachev comes to power, he suddenly has his freedom, and he travels to the United States, he travels elsewhere. How would you describe the last period of his life?
The last 3 years of his life, in a sense, well, he went from being enemy of the people to a people's deputy. He was officially elected. So he became directly involved in the shaping of Soviet politics at that time. He was able to leave the country. He always considered the right to leave one's country to be a fundamental human right, the right to leave and return. If you can't do that, then essentially you're a prisoner in your own country. Which he, like nearly every other Soviet, was. In all his years, he had never set foot outside of the Soviet Union until he was in his 60s. He simply had never been allowed abroad for various reasons. Once he was too valuable as a scientist, later because he was too dangerous as a dissident. I think those were years of immense work, sweet satisfaction, a great enjoyment of the world, which he had thought about so much but had never been allowed to see. He met everybody from Maggie Thatcher to Daniel Ellsberg, traveled every place he could go, and worked absolutely tirelessly to direct what was being called then glasnost and perestroika towards a reshaping of his country that he had always dreamt of himself. He always felt that the only solution to world problems was convergence, that the Soviet Union and the United States had to become more like each other so that the differences between them could not lead to nuclear war. And now he had a chance to actually see and shape that in action.
How would you assess his innovations as a scientist? What in fact did he create?
Sakharov's principal contributions, interestingly, come at the opposite extremes of science. He made important discoveries and posited, I would say more posited, important and useful theories in particle physics and in cosmology. That is to say, he was interested in both the very smallest and the very greatest of scientific questions. Great American scientists like John Wheeler acknowledged that their own thinking had been greatly influenced by Sakharov's views on the nature of gravity. What is gravity? How does it work? Is it made of anything? But Sakharov also gave a great deal of thought to the origin of the universe, and one of his favorite statements was that the most beautiful thing to him in all the world was the lingering hiss of the Big Bang, which could be picked up as background radiation noise, that we could still hear the creation of the universe with subtle enough scientific instruments was for him a source of tremendous pleasure. And he was the sort of scientist, a little bit like Einstein in this sense, but only a little bit, who by gazing or contemplating constantly the magnitude, the intricacy, the beauty of the universe, came essentially to a position that was almost religious, in the sense that Sakharov at the end of his days had to believe that there was more to the universe than we could ever know, and that there was something behind it all or within it all that was, I think he used the word warm, meaning that the universe is ultimately not cold, that there's something warm and alive in the very particles of existence, in the very nature of things.
Richard Lorre is the author of Sakharov, A Biography. His other books include The Autobiography of Joseph Stalin and Russia Speaks. Yesterday, Republican Congressman Chris Smith and Democratic Congressman Barney Frank introduced a joint resolution in Congress to grant posthumous honorary citizenship to Andrei Sakharov. I'm Margo Adler, and this is Fresh Air.